WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Former President Trump receiving a letter from the special counsel's office, according to sources telling him he's the target of an ongoing investigation into how he handled classified materials. Mr. Trump's repeatedly denied wrongdoing. Former Vice President Mike Pence officially kicking off his 2024 presidential bid today, along with North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. That brings to 12 the number of Republicans seeking the presidential nomination.
There's some in there that I don't know why they're running, quite honest.
Iowa voter Robert Byrd. The smoke from wildfires in Canada making air in the Northeast so bad, even visibility is low. New York Governor Kathy Hochul says it's unhealthy.
Our message right now is going to be reiterated multiple times because it is simply stay indoors. Outdoors is dangerous in just about every part of our state, not just vulnerable communities, but literally everyone.
Major League Baseball and the WNBA postponing games in New York and Philly. This is ABC News. Pope Francis remains in the hospital as he recovers from hernia surgery. Professional wrestling star The Iron Sheik has died.
He was one of the greatest villains in all of professional wrestling. The Iron Sheik, real name Hossein Khosrow Ali Vasiri, reveled in his bad guy image.
I call you a punk.
And was known for his legendary matches with Hulk Hogan and others in the 1980s. Born in Iran, Vasiri was a Greco-Roman wrestler who ended up moving to the U.S., helping to coach the Olympic wrestling team in 1972. He then joined the WWF, where his persona often played into tensions between the U.S. and Iran. He was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2005, and in recent years found fame on Twitter. The Iron Sheik was 81. Jason Nathanson, ABC News.
A new figure added to the U.S. Capitol's National Statuary Hall, bronze statue honoring Willa Cather, Pulitzer Prize-winning American author known for her portrayal of pioneer settlers. The statue's creator, Littleton Alston, is the first black artist to have work represented in the collection. Andy Field, ABC News.
Hey folks, keep her moving to Civic Media every Saturday and Sunday at noon for the Cripescast with me, Charlie Behrens.
We've been out here all day. We've had 5 or 6 beers and only one fish.
For Civic Media News, I'm Pete Schwabe. Here's what you need to know in Northeast Wisconsin. The city of Green Bay is hiring a coordinator to head up its violence prevention effort, according to the Green Bay Press Gazette. Earlier today, the city council approved an annual salary of $83,000 for up to 3 years. Governor Tony Evers announced the program that will treat violence as a public health issue on March 30th here in Green Bay. Green Bay Police Operations Commander Kevin Warwick calls gun violence a health epidemic that won't just disappear with more arrests. The violence prevention effort will be financed with a $1 million grant from the Wisconsin Communities Safer Fund, with the money coming from the American Rescue Plan Act. A Marinette woman is dead after sustaining injuries in a house fire. Firefighters found 58-year-old Susan Nielsen in a house on the 1900 block of Logan Avenue. Officials are still working to determine the cause of the fire. Pete Schwabe, Civic Media News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup. Starting at 6 a.m., The Mayor and Mino. Then at 8, The Earl Ingram Show. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude. And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show.
On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
The Todd Alba Show.
We'll be moving to the afternoon, Monday through Friday, 1 until 3. Trigvi Olsen has graciously agreed to follow us into the afternoon. We're going to get to talk about the Lincoln Project and politics in Wisconsin, all across the state of Wisconsin.
I know, isn't that exciting? Where the beer is cold, the cheese curds are squeaky, the Harleys roar, the Eagles soar, and the Packers score, Todd.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999. And again, 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger. Featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown.
Monday mornings at 8 on WISS and WGBW. And on the Civic Media app.
Oh my gosh, it's more fun than a big block of Colby or cheddar. The Cripes Cast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at therickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com, as we continue our Working Class Heroes radio tour. We stop here in Chicago, broadcasting out of the studios here at WCPT AM 820, one of our radio affiliates. I want to thank the good folks here for having us. What a fantastic facility. But I'm excited about my next guest because you love him, you know him. He's the guy who helps bring you labor history in two every day here on the program and on stations across the country. My good friend Larry Spivak, president of the Illinois Labor History Society. Larry, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, hi, Rick. It's good to talk to you again.
So let's start with that first. I mean, the labor history in two segments have been so popular. It's on about 70 stations across the country. It's one of these things that I keep saying, we've got to remember the history. We've got to remind people of where the working class struggles were, the people who fought, bled, and died for it. And right here in Chicago, where I would argue labor history kind of began.
That's something that we say here at the Illinois Labor History Society, as do historians and many other people. While that can be argued where it began, what you can say about Chicago is that it was an epicenter of labor activity going in the 19th century for a variety of reasons, which include where Chicago is situated and the location, the geography, but also, of course, the settling of the beginning of much industrialization moved from out east to the Midwest in the mid-19th century.
Yeah, now we're on this Working Class Heroes radio tour, and you know, going to places where manufacturing jobs were the heart of the community. It's what built the most prosperous working class in history, and I think people pine for the days. When unions were strong, when manufacturing was pumping, the life security, the opportunities that people got. But I think we forget that those manufacturing jobs, those steel mill jobs, those mining jobs, those weren't good jobs until they were union jobs. And I think we're in a moment where kind of remembering that is important.
Well, certainly it has come to the forefront of the nation's consciousness, I think, especially since the pandemic, as people were reevaluating the nature of work itself and realizing that now in industries that may not be heavy industry, although warehouse work is very difficult, where people are beginning to organize, frontline workers in healthcare have incredibly difficult jobs, not dissimilar in a many ways to dangerous industrial jobs, the kinds of hazards that people face. Obviously, there are other gig workers that are unorganized and are beginning to organize. But the notion that the unionization takes place only where there are is manufacturing is now a myth. It's in fact, most unionization is outside of manufacturing, although the highest density of unionization outside the public sector still takes place among energy workers and heavy, large industrial arenas.
Yeah, I'm hoping we get back to a day when you have insurance agents who are in unions, waiters and waitresses in unions, like we've had in the past, right?
Sure. I mean, I still have a little book that the bartenders union sold that they gave to their members on making drinks, you know, so the bartenders were organized and the hairdressers, and you could go on and on about all the what we might call a small individual skilled worker, small craft individual skilled workers who belonged to unions back, especially during that period after World War II.
Now, you know, we've just come out of Scranton, Pennsylvania here recently, and we took a coal mine tour. And what I found very interesting is while we were taking this tour, and this mine that we were in was, you know, working, you know, the late 1800s into the early 1900s. And, you know, the guy who's giving the tour was talking about how horrible the working conditions were, how the animals were treated better than the people, how children had a 50% fatality rate, the little nipper boys. And how, you know, just, you know, the conditions were just horrible. You know, there was, you know, filth and muck and, you know, you name it. It was just a treacherous, dangerous, horrible place. And one of the women in the group, and look, you know, bless her soul, but she goes, well, where was OSHA? And it was kind of one of these things, those head slap moments where people think that what we have today was always what we've had. And not understanding what it took to get those kind of things, which is why I think it's so important that you help us produce those labor history and twos that go out every day for people to kind of remember and maybe learn about things that they didn't when they were in school.
Yeah, my experience is that, and this is more with people who are already organized, but maybe not active, when they learn history, it encourages them, it inspires them to want to be active in their union and to take a greater role, because they say, oh, so I didn't, nobody ever taught me this. How come I never learned this? Certainly that's true of the general public who become aware of these significant historical labor history events through programs and other things that, for instance, that we provide. But it is especially among people who already have access to an organization, but didn't realize that that organization's history is what gave them the benefits that they now enjoy. So it's, it is absolutely a reminder, a facilitator for labor history is for helping people reach another level, which is to be active, to contribute towards the union that they're in or the association that they're in, because that's in fact how we've succeeded in the past.
And you're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Larry Spivak, president of the Illinois Labor History Society, the good folks who help us put out and produce our labor history in two segments. You can find that at our website, thericksmithshow.com. There's a box there. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to our podcast. You can make sure that you get those and share them with your friends. A little daily 2 minutes of labor history, a little education, a little thought, put in the head and make sure you share with your friends. But, you know, we're here in Chicago, home of the 8-hour day. And I was talking with someone the other day who was saying, you know, we don't need those 8-hour day laws anymore. We don't need that stuff because work is different. This is a brilliant argument. You know, back in the old days, Larry, work was difficult. It was manual. It was menial. And we were protecting people from the you know, the bosses being, you know, tyrannical. And now things are, well, we sit on the couch and, you know, tap away at our keyboards. So we don't need those protections anymore. What do you say to an argument like that?
You know, the dignity that we sometimes say is part of all work is taken out of work when people are forced or expected to work beyond a reasonable mean. And the 8-hour day is an arbitrary number. That was picked back in the mid-19th century as 8-hour day because people were working 14, 15, 16 hours a day. And 8-hour day, you know, the slogan, 8 hours of work, 8 hours of sleep, 8 hours for what you will, was a way to look at it in the day in three parts. But that, again, is arbitrary and socially constructed. 8 hours. Why 8 hours working as a nurse is an incredibly difficult job, and they usually work 12-hour shifts. It's again, arbitrary. And what we do know is that people are more productive when they can work shorter hours and produce the same amount, which is more likely when they don't have to work 8 hours. But, you know, the other side of it is that there are so many workers now who have to cobble together jobs to even get 8 hours. So they might work two jobs because of all the part-time contingent workforce in this country. So the nature of the eight-hour day, on one hand, is arbitrary. It was a very progressive movement to get it to be an eight-hour day that took, you know, decades and decades to get the laws, Fair Labor Standard Act and things like that passed. But it's there's no... divine reason that work should be 8 hours.
Yeah, but here's the thing that gets me, and this is where my mind went with this person. I'm going, you know, it's amazing how quickly and how easily we're willing to give up what people fought, bled, and literally died for. And here in Chicago, really the birthplace of the eight-hour day, and you can talk much more eloquently about this than I can. It's amazing to me that people are willing to go, well, you know, that was something we needed back then, but we're better than that now. We don't need it. And I'm often, you know, dumbstruck at how easy we're willing to negotiate away hard-fought battles of the past.
That's, the greatest driving force on policy changes regarding work tend to come from the profiteers. The corporate agenda sort of rules all of that, and what unions do, of course, is try to mediate and fight against those kinds of abuses, that the drive for profit that means more hours, less pay, more hours, less pay, or less hours, no benefits, less hours, no benefits. It all comes around to the same thing. So it is unfortunate that people lose sight of these things, don't know where it comes from. And when they, as we talked just a few minutes ago, when they do, they become a little more inspired. Work is very, very difficult, 8 hours in a day in many, many jobs, especially jobs where people have less control over have less autonomy, less control over the decision-making. You know, it may be one thing for a coder who has the flexibility, or today a lot of professional workers who can kind of set their own hours, although many of them work unreasonable amounts of hours because they can never turn it off. But most workers are still in a job where they have to be available every moment, all the time, for a period given of time. And it's stressful, it's difficult, and this isn't about... people shouldn't have to work hard to do a good job. It's about what's a reasonable social understanding of what makes a better quality of life for everybody. Some countries already in Scandinavia are experimenting with shorter days. This has been talked about in certain European countries, such as Germany, for years. It's not an easy question to resolve, but you know, the fight for the eight-hour day began after the Civil War and quickly headed to Chicago and culminating in the Haymarket event that we celebrate all around the world as International Labor Day. But again, we should always be thinking about whether the way we organize work should be the way it was for the last 50 years. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely.
Be better or be different?
No, we want it better. But, you know, the thing is, you know, we were talking about a shorter work day in this country, too, for a very short period of time. Back in the mid-1950s, there was some talk about a six-hour work day. In fact, you could go back to during the Depression when Kellogg's went to a six-hour day to ensure that workers, you know, I'm not saying the Kellogg Company was a great company and all that, but, you know, they kept people working during that time period. And it's something that we should be talking about it every time a recession hits, every time there's an economic downturn. So working people don't get completely screwed every time the capitalists screw up our economy.
Yeah. I think the other myth that exists is people, again, I use the term the corporate agenda, which drives a lot of the consciousness of how people think, because that's determined what is presented, you know, whether it's in the news or now, of course, you know, through internet-based news and digital media, et cetera, social media. But one thing that has not changed, if you go back the last 50 years when wages have declined in America or been stagnant, I should say stagnant for the last 50 years, 40 years for sure, is that corporate America profits have continued to go up. It doesn't mean that certain companies don't fail. Of course, certain companies fail. But the truth is that the rich got richer. This is a cliche that we hear about all the time. The one percenters, the rich are richer than ever, continue to profit for the last 40 years in ways that the vast majority, 70% to 80% of the workforce's wages are stagnant. It doesn't even make sense. And so productivity has been up during that whole period of time. So clearly we can rethink this idea of how many hours we work. Why not work 7-hour day or a 6-hour day and employ more people? You know, but the profit motive is so powerful and all-consuming that if which determines these sorts of things, unless you have a very powerful institution or institutions or collective action to put a stopgap against some of those abuses.
Now I get it from the corporate side. I get it from the CEO side. They want cheap labor. They want exploitable environmental rules. They want deregulation. I get that. But we the working people, we outnumber them. While they have all the money, we've out-procreated them. If we were united, if we were marching in the same direction, shoulder to shoulder, I think things might be a little bit differently, and we'd be having a different conversation. You know, one that would say, you know, should work be our life and our only part of our life, or should be what helps us fund our life? And the old frame of, you know, do I live to work or work to live? And I think you know, the railroad, you know, potential strike at the railroad was a huge part of that conversation.
Well, absolutely, because the railroad workers were working, especially since the pandemic, ridiculous amounts of hours. This whole idea of what is the amount of work that one should work is something that has existed, you know, 150 years. People have been talking about this. 8 hours of work, 8 hours of sleep, 8 hours, what we will. But, you know, a lot of people engaged in philosophical and social ideals would talk about why we have more time for ourselves, that we can make a better society because people can contribute to civic society. And as we all know, most people come home after 8 hours a day, which includes which really becomes a 10-hour day on average for people because of commuting and getting ready for work and everything else. By the time you've spent 8 to 11, 12 hours a day, your ability to participate in the other world of civic society is less and less. And
yep.
So that world now becomes dominated by a handful of people who feel that, well, I have a job that has flexibility. You know, if you look at people who are in library boards, people who are on village boards and, you know, things like that, or even commissions and communities, those often are people who have flexible work, who have the ability to determine their own schedule. And that's where it separates the average workforce from others. And those are the kinds of things that suggest why we should have a shorter work day.
No, that's an excellent point. Now, you know, obviously, as we've been talking about, and you're listening to The Rick Smith Show, we're here with Larry Spivak, president of the Illinois Labor History Society, the folks who help us get you labor history in two every day. You look at, you know, this being the area that brought the 8-hour workday to the forefront. Now, one of the pieces of legislation that's being pushed, an amendment to your Constitution to make sure that the Workers' Rights Amendment, to make sure that people's ability to join and form unions is in your Constitution. Could this be the beginning of another cycle of Chicago leading the way in labor rights and labor reform?
Well, certainly Illinois, and when we talk about, you know, we love to talk about Chicago, but it is an Illinois amendment, and hopefully could be a model for other states in the country to start doing this. Essentially, what this is, this workers' rights amendment does is it's kind of like taking The National Labor Relations Act that's been gutted from by 1947, and strengthening workers' ability to collectively bargain, not have to worry about right-to-work laws, which we know are right-to-work-for-less laws, and guarantee some of those ideas that will help it make it easier to organize across the state. So, yes, it could be a model for other states. And, you know, it's going to be difficult to pass because it needs 60%, and there's always low turnout in midterm elections. And what is most amazing, you can always tell the power of an idea by how it's opposed. And the billionaires are pouring tons and tons of money through their many front organizations, their fake newspapers. I hate using the word fake news because it was always used by the right wing, but, you know, they've created newspapers. AFSCME members in Illinois are getting mailings from the various right-to-work committees that come in different forms, which are funded by Richard Uihlein and Ken Griffin and, you know, the Liberty Center and Americans for Prosperity. It goes on and on and on. Why are they going to pump more than $100 million to try to defeat this? I have already seen, I was driving downstate, and I already saw a poster, I think it was. It was about the amendment that says, defeat the amendment and keep our taxes low. So, you know, it doesn't even make sense. But
defeat the amendment and love puppies.
That's right. So, you know, but once again, it all goes back to the idea that this is corporate driven, even though there are a lot of individuals who may participate, individuals who really don't understand what it's about, but follow the corporate agenda line. And that's what drives the anti-worker initiatives. You know, the Koch brothers fund all of this, as many of the other I call it right-wing, but pro-corporate lobby, you know, the Civic Club or the Commercial Club of Chicago. You could go on and on and on about the various organizations.
Yeah.
But and they have the real money.
Now, I go back to something my grandfather always said. He said, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. And this seems like that perfect situation because they're taking $100 million out of their pocket to tell working people that they don't need something. This is one of those moments where if that's the message, they're spending all this time, money, effort telling us we don't need something we absolutely need.
Yeah, and that's, of course, you know, we workers who are organized know this experience, who especially those who are active in unions, and how companies will spend more money to keep a union from getting a contract or being able to organize that would be if they just paid them wage increases.
Yeah, that's incredible.
You know, the idea that, yeah. So, you know, it all goes back to power, control, and profit.
It is incredible what they do. But, Larry, I appreciate you taking some time for it. It's always great to come to Chicago and get with you. Your wealth of knowledge. I hope folks will take a look at what you guys at the Illinois Labor History Society do. And, of course, thank you for the help with the labor history, and too. We love having them, and we love having you. Thanks so much, Larry.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Good stuff. Larry Spivak, president of the Illinois Labor History Society. If you want to hear, got some questions, want to hear some thoughts, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around to listen to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Real quick, want to point you in the direction of the Illinois Labor History Society, illinoislaborhistory.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can check out the work that they do there. And of course, they're the folks who helped us put together the labor history in two. And the reason I think it's so important that we continue to educate, inform, enlighten, engage, and talk about the past is because, look, it's coming back around. All of the horrible things that have happened in the past, there are those, look at our Supreme Court, wanting to revive that horrible. I think we're marching right back to the days of Lochner, the Lochner era, where if you're hungry enough and desperate enough to work in poverty conditions for desperation wages, hey, that's your liberty. That's your freedom. Which is why I hope you'll check out IllinoisLaborHistory.org for the work that they do. And, of course, our labor history in two segments, always there, always available. You can get that at TheRickSmithShow.com.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2010. That was the day 33 Chilean miners were finally pulled to safety after being trapped for 69 days. Workers had been mining copper and gold 2,300 feet down at the San Jose mine near the northern city of Copiapo when the mine caved in early August. The company waited several hours to notify authorities, and rescue efforts only began 2 days later. Trapped miners initially tried to escape through ventilation shafts, but found the required ladders missing. Each route they attempted was blocked by fallen rock or threatened additional collapse. A state-owned mining company took over the rescue efforts, and soon they began. As geologist Serena Sorensen noted, prospecting for people. Initial exploratory boreholes failed to locate miners because mine shaft maps had never been updated. Rescuers had no idea whether miners were even still alive. Finally, 17 days later, the eighth borehole reached them. The miners tapped on the drill and taped notes to it, alerting rescuers above that they were indeed alive and well. Food, medicine, and other supplies were lowered down to them as rescue efforts intensified. Mini cameras were also lowered down, and miners videotaped messages of their continued ordeal. They told how they continued to search for possible escape routes and agreed to ration their limited food supplies so they could all survive. The first of three drilling plans to free the miners began. It was an international effort. The Chilean Navy consulted with NASA to design and construct the rescue pods. Throughout the entire process, rescuers worked to prevent additional cave-ins and rock falls. Finally, the extraction process began, and in less than 48 hours, all miners emerged as heroes.
The problem with our so-called free market is that it's not free for you and me. It's largely controlled by monopolies, which are free to inflate prices just because they can, letting gougers gleefully extract unwarranted monopoly profits from us. This milking of consumers by tightly consolidated industries is propelling today's surging price hikes. Brand name corporations claim they're being forced to mark up price tags just to cover rising costs for raw materials, labor, transportation, etc. But in a competitive marketplace, they'd have to eat much of those increases by taking a bit less in profits. Indeed, monopolies are now raising prices simply to squeeze even greater profits from hard-hit consumers, a game of corporate greed that socks America with more inflation. Consider diapers. A year ago, Procter & Gamble announced that the pandemic was driving up its production costs, forcing it to raise prices for its Pampers brand. At the time, it had just posted a quarterly profit of $3.8 billion, so P&G could easily have absorbed a temporary rise in its costs. But instead of holding the price to ease their customers' economic pain, the conglomerate used a global health crisis to justify upping diaper prices. 6 months later, P&G's quarterly profit topped $5 billion. And in that same quarter, P&G spent $3 billion to buy back shares of its own stock, a Wall Street manipulation that artificially bloats the wealth of top executives and other big shareholders. In short, P&G used the excuse of inflation to inflate the price of their diapers, then use the extra money it extracted to inflate the value of its stock to benefit rich shareholders. This is Jim Hightower saying, well, Couldn't consumers just switch to Huggies, the brand sold by P&G's main competitor? No, for it's a co-monopolist, having also goosed up its prices.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So you may remember a couple of days ago on the program, we were talking about our experience up in Scranton. We took the tour at the Lackawanna coal mine. And again, you know, we forget how dangerous, how horrible working conditions used to be. We forget that work used to be poverty-level work, that employers really super cheated people, even though still going on, wage theft, one of the biggest crimes in our country right now. But we do it in a much nicer way. No longer do you come home and find the dead body of a loved one as your eviction notice. No more do you find that you have to send your children into the mines or into the mills just to put food on the table. We're a little bit more civilized. The question is how much more? And that's why I reached back and asked John Pesta to come talk with us. John was the tour guide and a fabulous tour guide. And if you're ever in the Scranton area, you have to take this tour and you have to ask for John to do that. But John Pesta, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome.
So, you know, how long have you been doing these tours? Because I got to tell you, I'm not blowing smoke. You were fabulous.
Thank you. I've been doing it since 2015.
And what made you get into this?
My brother worked there before me on the weekends. And just to keep the history alive, in my retirement, it was something to do. And it really was an eye-opening experience. I knew... that my father was a miner, but he died when I was 8 years old. And after he died, we sort of lost touch with my father's side of the family. It was more like my mother's side. So when I started working up there and started doing some research, I just learned an awful lot about my own family. Things that even my oldest living brothers sometimes just didn't want to recount, I realized how lucky I was being the youngest of my father's children. And coming along when I did, even though we were poor, I didn't know we were poor, and I certainly didn't live in the conditions that my older two brothers grew up in, or spent their early childhood in, I should say. Even though it was the 40s, that area of the Wyoming Valley here in Pennsylvania was still very backward and still very much a coal community, and my father had only gone to third grade, and when he divorced his first wife, he got custody of my two brothers, and they would have to read to him, the grocery bill and things like that, because he only went to third grade before he went to work in the mines.
That's incredible. And again, we think back and go, wow, that was so long ago. It really wasn't that long ago. As you've pointed out, it's one person's lifetime.
That's exactly right.
I remember when I first moved to Pennsylvania, I met a guy who said when he came back from Vietnam, they gave him a little bit of money, and he paid his family's debt to the company store, basically. And he said it was the first time in 100 years that his family had not been in debt to this particular company, because it was the coal company. And we forget that these companies had ways of paying people and cheating people. And I found that to be particularly interesting on the tour and in the museum that you guys had, the talk of company script and the fact that your entire life was dominated by the company store, the company doctor, the company.
Yeah, that goes back a little before my family. My father was first-generation American, so his father was a miner in a sort of remote area of what is today Poland, part of Poland. And some of those miners, the immigrants, they came here looking for a better life. And a lot of them turned around and went right back to where they came from. That's really, I guess that's not common knowledge, but they turned around and went back because it just, the streets certainly weren't paved with gold here. Now, by the time my father went to work, as far as I know, I know where the original house he lived in was. That was destroyed by the flood in 1972 here in the Wyoming Valley. They did not, it was at that time, there was not a company store. So that had already passed. There were little neighborhood stores and so on, but all of them extended credit to all the miners. And that's just the way it was. Like I said, my brother just had to read the grocery bill to my father so he knew what he was paying for and so on.
Yeah. Now, what I found interesting is as we were going through the museum, you know, the 16 tons and what do you get, another day older and deeper in debt phrase is there. But there was no talk of organizing. There was no talk of the mine workers union. I didn't see any. Is that on purpose? Is that deliberate?
No. In fact, I never really thought about it until you mentioned it. I looked at the organized labor. I just assumed it was part of it. And I try not to be too terribly political. And sometimes if you start bringing up unions, people get a little bit defensive.
No, see, I don't see it that way, John. I see it as people coming together and making their lives better. And I remember during the tour, you were talking about just how horrible the working conditions were. And at that moment, you go, this is the reason people organize. This is the reason for their own safety, for the safety of their children.
Yeah. As I recall, on your tour there, I was having a little trouble speaking. I had a terribly hoarse throat. And so I did skip one. I don't remember where we stopped at we called it the shanty of the fire boss there. That's normally where I tell a story sometimes, depending on how much time we have on the tour and how interested the group is, about one of the ways the miners or the coal barons took advantage of the miners was keeping them separate in terms of their languages. After the strike of 1902, and again, I don't pass myself off as a historian by any nature. This is just stuff that I picked up from reading and learning with the tours. After the strike of, one of the things that I read, after the strike of 1902, there was a standardized pay instituted among the anthracite fields. And when I talk about the coal mining, I'm not just, you know, thinking about the anthracite miners. I'm thinking about, you know, the bituminous miners of West Virginia and so on as well, and all the other bituminous mines in the United States. But the after that strike, I read an account where many of the coal companies stopped giving the miners test and the foreman's test in any other language but English. That was their way around paying the standardized scale. So qualified miners, qualified foremen couldn't pass those tests, would have to work for laborers' wages.
Of course.
And that only increased the ethnic
division, how they kept people pitted against each other, how they kept them from organizing. And look, this is the brilliance of what the wealth class has always been able to do. They've been able to slice and dice and divide people so that they're fighting each other instead of going after them. And this, to me, was another perfect example, because you did tell the story of how they kept people separate and kept them divided. And because I think it's important to point that out, because I think we're in that kind of moment now, that we're dividing people based on whatever ethnicity, whatever, you know, gender, whatever fault lines they can find. We're figuring out how to be eating each other instead of going after what really matters, better wages, hours, conditions.
Exactly. I hate to sound like this, but as long as profit is the ultimate motive, we're going to continue to be victims.
Yep. No, and you pointed that out in the tour as well, that I thought was interesting. You were talking about robbing the pillars, which is something that I hadn't thought of, because when you showed us the diagram of how this mine was constructed, my first thought is, how is this thing not collapsing in on itself? And then when you said, look, you know, on the way out the door, they were robbing and stealing because they didn't care about the people on the top.
No. In fact, I don't know if you had a chance to watch the little video we put together for the hoist house. There, when I was doing the research there, trying to find, you know, public domain clips to make that video, I found one where, it wasn't public domain, that's why it's not in there. A whole city block in Scranton had fallen into the mine. The pillars collapsed, and a whole city block just sank right into the mine. I think it was somewhere in the 19-teens, but some company had claimed copyright on this section of video, and so I was afraid to use it. But now that the mining has, in essence, stopped here, at least in the northern field, the subsidences, as far as we know, have really slowed down quite a bit. The last one that I truly suspect was a couple of years ago. There's the route I take to the mine. They claimed there was a sinkhole on the road. Well, it was closed for months, and then they said it was a water main break. Well, you know, there was no water. It was likely a mine subsidence.
Right.
And it just took months to correct. But they just, it seems that the area media doesn't want to remind people what's underneath their homes, and it really is quite extensively mined out underneath the Wyoming Valley, the Lackawanna Valley.
It's incredible, especially what you showed us. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with John Pesta, tour guide at the Lackawanna coal mine tour in just outside of Scranton. And I highly suggest if you're in the Scranton area, this is some place that you have to go and experience for yourself. They actually take you deep down into the mine. You get to walk through and experience how dark it is. And I'll tell you, that's one of the things that grabbed my attention, just how dark and imagining having to work in those conditions. It's mind-blowing. But I want to go back to what you said a second ago about how tightly controlled the message is with these mine companies. Because, you know, we went a couple years ago to Blair, West Virginia to talk about the Battle of Blair Mountain. And, you know, basically we were almost attacked by the Friends of Coal. And out of that came, you know, these people saying this is all we have, even though the coal companies were screwing them over at every opportunity. They've been led to believe that this is it, and it's, you know, just destroying their environment and doing all these things. But the message is so tightly controlled, and people are so you know, attacked when they try and just bring out reality. As you've said, a lot of these sinkholes, a lot of these things could be the fact that, you know what, they did rob the pillars. They did pull out more than they were supposed to because they didn't care about what was on top.
No. I think I mentioned when we were on our tour about the recent collapse on Interstate 70 out at the West Virginia-Pennsylvania border from longwall mining underneath the interstate. That never made our state news all around. It never made national news. That bridge in Ohio collapsed. A couple of cars went down into the river, and that was national news for days. But the longwall mining underneath I-70, and that's been going on for a while. I had a friend who was a former tour guide up here who lived out there. I was a bituminous miner. And, you know, there's that bridge collapse. The taxpayers are going to pay for it, but no one ever heard of it. The poor little company, the little news station that tried to get the story, got shut down immediately. The company went to court and had all their operations considered trade secret. Well, I don't know what could be trade secret about longwall mining. They've been doing it for decades now. But that's just the kind of stuff. I mean, money talks. The company slaps a gag order, and that's that.
And this is where organized people, organized workers need to be at the forefront pointing this stuff out. And I'm glad that you brought it up because it was the first that I had ever heard of that. You know, when we see these sinkholes, and I know I live near Harrisburg where there's sinkholes all the time, and you're told, no, that's just the water underneath, and I'm sure there's no mining there. But we don't think that this could be the what happened 100 years ago, the ramifications of you know, what past generations have done.
Yes. The damage is, I don't know if you had a chance to make it to the sinkhole while you were up here, just to see that one sinkhole there in Old Forge, the borehole, I mean, not sinkhole. The water pouring out of that is just an eye-opening experience, and that's just one of the drainage outlets into the Susquehanna River Basin. And that's just one river here in the, you know, in the coal fields. The long-term damage, I just don't understand why, if Americans would just get together and say, listen, we're not going to stand for this anymore. You know, I mean, if we, you know, like a union, well, for example, I read a book when I started doing the tours up there, and the book was from 1907, and I can't remember the title of it, but in 1907 in the Scranton area, according to this book, every time there was an election, more than half the faculty of the public schools changed. Well, you know, when teachers today, or when people today complain about the teachers union, that's what the teachers union, the primary thing the teachers union was formed,
yep,
to stop.
To stop patronage.
You know, in an election, you lose your job, and that's it. It had nothing to do with teacher qualifications. It had everything to do with who you know and who you voted for. And there's just still so much of that. And if we as consumers brought our power as consumers to bear against some of these, you know, people that are destroying our environment for money, I think we could make a difference. But it's a matter of finding somehow to organize.
No, and that's the I couldn't have said it better myself, because we're in this moment where we're told we have to have all of these dirty energies and all of this stuff and tear things out of the ground and all of this. And I'm going, I think we have technology that can move us in a different direction. But, you know, we're still kind of hung up, because I think we're in a situation where in my conversations with the people in West Virginia, who, you know, the biggest guy in the place with the biggest gun and the biggest hat, he said, it's all I've got. And that kind of Hunger Games scenario, we have to, as policymakers and as people who push for policy, have to make it that that's not how things are, that there's something else for people to be able to do to move to the next thing. So it isn't the end of their existence, because I think we can be moving away.
We have hundreds of millions of dollars to give in foreign aid. How about some domestic aid for people like that? I mean, it's not rocket science.
So I find it interesting. I mean, you give these tours. So where do you find yourself on the coal debate? Because I know some people. In fact, one of the guys we spoke there was, all in favor of, we should be mining all this stuff, because the anthracite mine that you point out is the best in the world. And you gave a great presentation on that. It's not that dirty, bituminous. And there's even that debate on one and the other.
Well, this anthracite burns cleaner than all the coals. That's not to say it burns clean. It burns cleaner because it has less impurities in it. But the people who want to keep digging that coal seem to have forgotten about acid rain in the 70s. That's still sulfuric acid in the atmosphere. That's raining on our cars, our houses, our crops, our kids,
I mean, it's amazing what we've done. And, again, back to the working conditions. The fact, one of the things that was kind of surprising is, you were saying how the kids, the phrase that caught my attention is light is money. I think you said that.
And, yeah, everything was money in the mines.
Yeah, everything was money. But the fact that they had this contraption on their head that was basically leaking chemicals into their forehead, it was one of those things where you go, is this what you would do with your own children, especially thinking about it in this moment?
Yeah, when you think about the conditions for some of the children, it's absolutely unbelievable. It's like something you would see in a third world country. But it was right here under the feet of quite literally, this was happening under the feet of the wealthy people who were on the correct side of the tracks. I mean, when I think about the town where I grew up, quite literally, there was a set of railroad tracks. And where my father and my two older brothers lived when they were children, that was literally the wrong side of the tracks. You went across the tracks, and that's where the big houses were. That's where the coal barons lived, the business people lived. You went, back to the other side of the tracks, and that's where the coal miners lived and the poor kids. It was just that simple. Those poor kids were working literally under the feet of the rich.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, the wealth of this nation, the building of the Industrial Revolution, the fighting of wars, our transcontinental railroad being built, all of this wealth, all of this infrastructure, all of this stuff built off the backs of those children in those mines who, I think you said the little Nipper boys had a 50% fatality rate. Can you imagine sending your child anywhere?
Yeah, that was not I who said that. I'm just to correct you there. It wasn't I who said that. I think that was Edmund, the boss there. He might have mentioned that to you. Yeah, because that's a statistic I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, I think it was Ed, now that I go back to it. But the fact that, if there's a 10% chance that my kid's not coming home today, I'm not sending them.
Oh, no. Could you imagine a modern parent of any kind, of any ilk today, sending their 5, 6, 7-year-old child into a mine of that depth with that danger? It's just unheard of.
It's crazy. So let me ask you last line of questioning, because, again, I hope folks, if they're in the Scranton area, that they go to the Lackawanna coal mine tour. Ask for John Pesta as your tour guide, because you did a fabulous job. And if I ever come back,
you're
going to be the guy I want to see. What's the message you want folks to know out of this? What would you have wanted me to take away from that tour that maybe I didn't?
If we don't understand where we came from and what we are doing to the planet that we live on, we are doomed. I mean, look at the damage that just the coal mining alone has done. And back, what was it, I think if you look on our unofficial website, in 1912, I think it was the tour guide Jim who found this. In 1912, there was a report about how much damage burning coal is going to do to the atmosphere and cause global warming. In 1912, they knew that.
Yep.
But they went ahead and did it anyway.
It's the same thing they did when they put lead in gasoline. It's the same thing. It was all about the money. It was about how much they could put into their pockets at the expense of poor and working class people.
I mean, we just slammed a tiny little spacecraft into a tiny little asteroid millions of miles from this planet. You mean to tell me we can't power a house with the sun?
And that's coming from someone who's a coal miner.
That's coming from a coal mine family.
Wow. John, I appreciate it. And that is the message that I think we should be taking from this. It was great talking with you. I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts with us down the road.
Thank you very much. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much. Good stuff, John Pesta. Make sure, again, if you got the opportunity, the Lackawanna coal mine tour in Scranton, Pennsylvania, make sure you get there. It is well worth the time. And as my producer said, spend an hour down in the mine and grateful I'm never going to have to go back again. That the message there. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. The talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at TheRickSmithShow.com. This is the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So again, you know, I listened to John, and the reality of the situation that we're in is, again, I keep coming back to this frame. Remember what it was like in the past. Remember what the working conditions were like for past generations and what it took of those workers to fight, bleed, and die for the things that we have today. It's really remarkable to me that now we're willing to bargain this stuff away. And I go back to my conversation with Larry Spivak, the on the 8-hour day front. Literally had someone tell me, well, you know, we don't need that today because we're so much better. We don't do the kind of hard work that the 8-hour day was meant to protect menial laborers from. Seriously, this is the kind of messaging that the wealth class continues to throw out at us. To kind of go, yeah, we're not down in the mines anymore. What do we need an 8-hour protection for? I don't know. Maybe you want to see your children. Maybe you'd like to see your wife every once in a while. Maybe you'd like to, I don't know, do anything else. And this is that kind of messaging that kids, yeah, it's easier to, you know, type away at the computer on your couch. Diminishing what people actually do. The kind of labor that we do. And it may be different, but it's still bits and pieces, hours of your day, hours of your life that you're trading away to be able to put food on the table, a roof over your head. And we've got to be talking in those terms. Yeah, we may be a little cleaner. We may do a little bit easier of labor, but it's still hours of our lives. It's still that kind of fight that we need to continue, which again is why I think it's so important to remember our history and why solidarity matters. And every generation has to rediscover it. And I think we're in that moment. As we've been talking about, we're in a moment where workers' rights are at the forefront, where there is a push to get people organized, where there is a thirst for it. When 71% of the people in this country agree on anything, approve of anything, you know we're heading in a direction that I'm hoping is positive. And that means politically, this is where the wealth class is really freaking out because, you know, as was said earlier, they're spending a ton of money fighting back this workers' right amendment here in Illinois. And why are they fighting back so hard? Why do they want to push for the no rights at work agenda? Well, because it means more for them and less for you. It means they get the power, the control, the wealth that comes with, well, with the best democracy money can buy. And we've got a chance. We've got a chance. This is why voting matters, which is why they're trying to take it away. That's why we're in Chicago, obviously, for the Greg Palast movie Vigilante, to talk about, you know, the idea of an injury to one being an injury to all. If they're taking the vote away from one segment, eventually they're going to come for all of us. You know, I remember when I first started voting, I had someone say, you know, well, if it really mattered, they wouldn't let you do it. And they go, what a stupid thing to say. They want to diminish our belief that we have power, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in society. Empowered citizens, something they don't want. People who are saying, no, we want a better opportunity. We want better for our children. We want better schools. We want better infrastructure. We want better jobs. We want better opportunities. We want a better future. That's not what they want. They want tax cuts. They want deregulation. They want power. That's simple. Love to hear your thoughts. If you miss any of the tour, TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you get it. Email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Of course, if you miss any of our trip thus far on the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour, make sure you grab the podcast. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time. This is the best of The Rick Smith Show.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
ABC News.